Welcome to EJB Talks, Rutgers Blaustein School experts in policy, planning, and health, where we talk with our faculty and staff experts, as well as students, about how the fields of public policy, urban planning, public health, health administration, and public and urban informatics affect your lives. Welcome to EJB Talks. I'm Stuart Shapiro, the Associate Dean of Faculty at the Blaustein School, and the purpose of this podcast is to highlight the work my colleagues and our alumni in the fields of policy, planning, and health are doing to make the world, the country, and New Jersey a better place. In our continuing series of talking with recently retired and retiring faculty, today I'm honored to be speaking with Professor Emeritus Bob Lake, who led our doctoral program for years and also helped shape our world-ranked urban planning program. Bob, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Stuart. I'm really happy to be here.
So we've been starting these with generally with sort of origin stories. How did you come to the Blaustein School?
Yeah, so I kind of think that it was the other way around, that the Blaustein School came to me. I came to Rutgers in 1974. I was still a doctoral student, aspiring PhD. I was looking for dissertation data, and my dissertation advisor gave me a list of people on the East Coast to talk to, and one of them was at Rutgers. And I made an appointment. I showed up. We had a conversation. I didn't find any data, but they offered me a job.
And boy, things were different back then.
Things were definitely different. It was a little more complicated than that. I came back for an interview and so on. But that was, like I said, in 1974. And it wasn't until several decades, actually, later that the Blaustein School was established. And in that time, I had started teaching courses in the planning department. It was a department at that time, and that was fun. And so there was a very close connection between where I was at the Center for Urban Policy Research and the Department of Planning and Public Policy and policy development. So when the planning and policy departments got blended into the Blaustein School, there I was. And all of a sudden, I came to work one day and they said, guess what? You're now a faculty member in the Blaustein School. And I said, cool. And the rest was history.
In a brand spanking new building, which is now, of course, 25 years old. But so when I came to the Blaustein School, and we're talking about 2003 here, I had my degree in public policy. I had worked in Washington. And I really, if I was being honest with myself, had no idea what urban planning was. And now that I know you, I probably should have gone to you first for asking the question, what is urban planning? So if I came to you today or if someone else came to you today, how would you answer that question?
Sure. So, you know, I think the old line is if you ask 10 urban planners to define urban planning, you'll get 12 different answers.
And that's true at the Blaustein School.
And that's certainly true at the Blaustein School, which is interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, people from a variety of backgrounds and perspectives all coming together in this collective project called planning, which, you know, in the generic sense means thinking about where you want to go and how you want to get there. And the definition or the job of the planner has definitely evolved considerably over the, 100 years or so that has been a recognized activity. You know, back in the day, planning was municipal engineering. It was building sanitary systems and water supply systems and responding to the devastation of the tenement life in the old industrial city, where people were piled on top of each other, without sanitation, without water, without air and light. And people looked around and said, you know, we can do better. And the doing better was the origin of the idea of planning. And it kind of went on from there. My favorite quote on the question comes from one of my favorite philosophers, John Dewey, who talked about...
Who you just wrote a book about, right?
Who I just wrote a book about and who occupies a lot of my waking hours, who talked about moving from the idea of the planned city to the idea of the planning city, by which he meant the planned city is the idea that somebody has in their head and then tries to implement on the ground. And the planning city is a continuous process of looking around, evaluating what we're doing and how we're living and how we're arranging our lives and thinking about how to improve it. And instead of the planned city being imposed on people, the planning city is a city that engages people in a continuous process of figuring out how they want to live together. And in the simplest terms, or maybe the most complex terms, that's my definition of planning.
So you mentioned sort of engaging the community there and that being a part of the planning city. Let's go off in that direction now. And let's talk about community engagement. You know, in some senses, community engagement right now is at record levels. I mean, you look at school board meetings. My wife is a school board vice president here in our town. And, you know, people turning out in droves for them. You talk about other kinds of public meetings and you talk about even public spaces and dialogues. You see a lot of it. But at the same time, it's not really, I think, sort of what planners think of as the kind of community engagement that moves us forward. And I'm wondering what your perspective is on that.
Sure. So, you know, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that people are engaged, and the bad news is that people are engaged, right? And the real challenge is how to organize and channel and educate that engagement so that it can move the world in positive directions. Engagement is a real problem when the world is as it seems to be today, is polarized, is divided into us and them, is focused on differences and distinctions rather than similarities and common needs. And so, you know, throughout history, the idea of participation, of political engagement, of democracy has been a very double-edged kind of thing. You know, the founding fathers writing the Constitution were very, as you well know, being a policy analyst, were very skeptical about democracy, even as they built democracy into the very foundations of the Constitution. You know, we have an electoral college because the founders didn't think that the population was sufficiently capable of electing a president, and we needed a special group of electors to make that decision. Up until it was changed through amendments, the Constitution did not allow for the popular election of the Senate until that was changed. And in many, many other ways, while the original idea behind establishing this republic was about popular governance and democracy, there were all sorts of ways that was hedged around and limited to prevent what the, you know, in the Federalist Papers, there's lots of discussion about the dangers of factions.
Right.
And
Federalist
people,
10. Yeah,
exactly. People being divided up and then organized on the basis of a single idea that divides them from everybody else, and the challenge then is to figure out not what is wrong with democracy, but how to make it work better. And you know, Winston Churchill famously or not, it might be apocryphal, define democracy as the best system out there, as the worst system out there, except for all the others.
Right.
And I think that's probably where we are. Right.
Yeah. So a lot of the past, you know, century have been, you know, very well intended attempts to take down some of those guardrails against popular participation that the founders had erected. And some of them were initially put in for racist, for sexist, for all sorts of reasons, and removing them was a good thing. I guess the question is, and you're talking about this a little bit, is, you know, how do we function with those guardrails gone? And is where we are now sort of what happens when we take the guardrails off?
Yeah. So, you know, it seems to me we have two options when we're thinking about this idea of democracy and all of the problems and challenges that presents. We can, as I think Churchill was hinting at, we can just throw the idea out, mm-hmm. right? And then, of course, we're stuck with the what then question, mm-hmm. right? Democracy doesn't work because people are disengaged, they're apathetic, they're biased, they're caught up in these factions and cults and ways, limited ways of thinking. Popular democracy just means that people are going to be biased in their judgments and exclusionary. And so there's no hope here. Just forget it. Right. And then, of course, the question is, well, then what do you do? And that leaves either dogmatic authoritarian rule by those who claim to have the answers, or complete anarchy, right? And nothing much in between. So if we're stuck with this idea, then the challenge is, okay, how do we work to make it better? Mm-hmm. And this, I think, leads us into an avenue, a way of thinking that I think will be really frustrating for a lot of people, which is that we have to do the hard, long, dirty work of educating a democratic public to be better Democrats, small d Democrats, right? If people aren't democratically capable citizens, then it's the job of society, and especially our job as educators, to help people become better democratically capable citizens. And that's something that happens over a lifetime, over several lifetimes, against the grain of all of the other influences that are moving in the opposite direction, and into which many, many people are invested in maintaining. But if we're unhappy with the way democracy is working, then our challenge is to roll up our sleeves and dig in for the long haul of figuring out how to make it better.
So I know you haven't been in the classroom and now in a year, but you're not that far removed from it. You know, at sometimes you read things that people are losing faith in democracy and that they're falling into that first camp that you've described, that it doesn't work. I have to say that's not what I see in the classroom with my students. And we don't talk about it a lot. I teach economics, so it doesn't come up a ton, but you know, we have discussions about issues and such, and it's clear they've sort of bought into the system of making decisions and making it better. But I'm wondering what your perspective is on that in terms of where particularly young people, but even people at large are in sort of their views of building democracy or shelving democracy.
Yeah, you know, the from my perspective, the delightful part about being a college teacher, college professor, and maybe especially in a field like planning and public policy, is that the students that come into this program, I think it's fair to say across the board, do so because they believe that the world can be better and that they can play a role in in moving the world in a better direction. And generation after generation after generation of students come into the programs committed to that idea. And what they're looking for in a planning and policy school is the skills, the techniques, the knowledge, the perspectives, the lessons from past successes and failures that will then equip them to contribute to that project of making the world a better place. And, you know, you can be sarcastic about it. You can be cynical about it. And you know, all of those young people, they're so idealistic and naive, and the world is tough and miserable, and they better figure that out, right? But, you know, then we might as well just throw up our hands and live in a cave, right? So, yeah, you know, I see that, and we sometimes kind of lose sight of that ideal, right? When we're, you know, that, well, what we're really doing is teaching students how to use regression equations to project population projections or something, right? And we get caught up in the methods or the, you know, how wide does a sidewalk have to be to allow for efficient movement of people? Yeah, you know, all of those kind of factual and methodological issues are important, but they are all in service of encouraging that ethos of working together to make the world a better place. And that's our job.
Yeah, it's an interesting balance to try and strike because, you know, I completely agree that the idealism needs to be fostered, and we need to make sure that they come out of school with the same idealism they came into it with. But like you said earlier, this is hard work, you know, sustaining it. And it's never been clearer than in the past 5 years that sustaining a democracy and doing the work there is hard. You have to talk to people you don't agree with. You have to convince them of ideas that they may be, you know, maybe you've never heard before, maybe hostile to, whatever. And so it part of the challenge, I think, is, you know, taking some of that cynicism and telling the students, you know, okay, now go out there with your ideals, but be ready to push them in a way that's productive and that moves us forward to that democratic ideal.
Yeah, you know, without a doubt, it's hard work. If it was easy, we would have done it a long time ago.
Right.
Right. Or whenever we thought we whoever our ancestors, you know, professional ancestors were, might have thought they had resolved a problem or solved a problem or accomplished something, the world changes. We get confronted by new realizations, the emergence of new issues and new problems. Things that we thought were fine last year turns out not to be so fine because we have new information or a new perspective, or the world has changed and presented us with new issues. And so
you have a global pandemic.
Or you have a global pandemic or the equivalent. Absolutely. Yeah. Like I say, if it were easy, we would have been out of a job a long time ago.
Well, we're both fortunate, I guess, that it's not easy, because I think we've both had a lot of fun where we are. And we're also lucky to be, as you noted, in policy and planning fields where we do get the kind of students we get. And I think at a public university in particular. As you look back at your time at Rutgers and at Blaustein, What do you look back at fondly now that you've had a year or so of distance and perspective there?
Sure. You know, that's an easy one. It's the interaction with students. It's the interaction with students who are incredibly smart, incredibly interested and interesting, incredibly curious, incredibly willing to grapple with the hard questions. You know, the experience of sitting in a seminar or a classroom with a group of really smart, really committed, really intellectually open and aware students and talking about issues, ideas, reading through somebody's work, taking it apart, critiquing it, figuring out what we can learn, and then just seeing the engagement and hearing the engagement and seeing those light bulbs of awareness and realization going off over all of those heads. It's unparalleled. And the privilege of being able to spend my time and occasionally even get paid to engage in that activity is just a gift. And I miss it in retirement, and I look for it wherever I can find it. But clearly, those kinds of interactions, that gift of being able to think together with other thinking people was priceless. And that's what kept bringing me back to work every day for 46 years.
couldn't agree more. Bob, thanks for coming on today.
Thank you, Stuart, and take care and good luck.
Big thank you to Bob and as well to our production team, Amy Cobb and Karen Olson. We'll see you next week with another talk from another expert from the Weilstein School. Until then, stay safe.